last year, but also Binyan Mishkan. And there's a lot of high emotions and charged feelings because this Mishkan, at least according to Rashi, according to the Ramban, had already been commanded well before the Chedega. And all their hopes and dreams had been dashed, and all the plans had been suspended, and they were facing annihilation, and Moshe intervened and davened for them, and they were rescued and forgiven, and now there's a redo. So whether this Mishkan succeeds is not just a question of the success of the project, but a referendum on whether Hashem has accepted their penitence. Because if the Mishkan will be successful, then evidently in Shemayim the tshuvas were accepted. If the Mishkan will belly flop, then evidently HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want their tshuva. So the day is here, Moshe gathers everyone. And you'd expect him to give a really important speech. Here we are, gathered here in front of the Mishkan, Vayakel Moshe, as Kol Adas B'nai Yisrael. The entire camp is gathered. And then Moshe takes a detour. And he talks about Shabbos. Eila ha-dvarim asher tziva Hashem lasos osa. So what? Mishkan, Korbanos, Kohen, Big Day Kahuna. Sheshes yamim tasem malacha. I haven't been counting, but I think this is number 4 or 5 mention of Shabbos. We heard about it in Bishalach. We heard about it in Yisrael. We heard about it in Mishpatim. We heard about it in Kitisa. I think Kitisa twice, right? Depending on how you read the pasuk, Bechar Shabbatzei Tishbos, in the end of the parsha, but at least once in Kitisa. So Bishalach, Yisrael, Mishpatim, Kitisa twice. 5 mentions of Shabbos. And Nachamo, one more time, Moshe has to mention Shabbos when they're all gathered and everyone has their eyes fixed upon the Mishkan and fixed upon Moshe and fixed upon Aaron. So the answer is obvious, but that answer itself raises an additional question. The answer is, yeah, but the mention of Shabbos in the context of Mishkan has a particular halachic message. It's one thing to mention Shabbos in Bishalach and in Aseres HaDibros and in Parshas Mishpatim, but when the discussion of the Mishkan unfolds, so the juxtaposition between Mishkan and Shabbos tells us that we can't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. We have to halt the process on Shabbos. But even that is a repetition because we already had that in Kitisa. If you remember, the opening section of Kitisa listed Bitzalel and Aliyah and the Hashem and HaMishkan, the Ketaras HaSamim, Vishamu V'Neizol, Sashav Aslasos, and Rashi there quotes the Gemara, Lama Nismacha, Parshas HaShabbos, and Lechas HaMishkan, Tell you it's Aser. So this is a repeat of a repeat. We already had this juxtaposition of Mishkan and Shabbos. What makes Vayakel different? Why does Moshe take an opportunity to mention Shabbos again? And to answer that question, we have to ask a different question. Because Shabbos is a very, very peculiar set of halachas. It's fundamental, theological, experiential. Someone that's not mechal Shabbos, someone that's not shomer Shabbos is a mumer l'chol ha'tara kula. If you don't keep a mitzvah, you're still Jewish, you're still from, and you're treated as halachically firm. But if you intentionally violate Shabbos, we call it a mechal Shabbos. And halachically, he's out. And yet, the halachas are very slippery. What's aser? I don't know. What does the Torah say is aser? Well, I know, but maybe I don't know because I can't find it anywhere in the Torah. Because all the lama tests of halachos, which is a very extensive list, just think about it. Which other halacha has 39 principles? You'd be hard to find a mitzvah with 39 details. I mean, the details of details of details, but 39 separate categories. The Torah doesn't mention one. Hinta does mention one. So we're left to learn out, as the Gemara says in Bava Kama, Mirtz Hashem. Hopefully everyone in this room will learn this Gemara next year. The Gemara says in Bava Kama, that Be'ezim and Aleph, Hach to have a little subliminal Shanab, Hach to have a Mishkan Chashiva. If it was an activity that took place in the Mishkan, it's Asur and Shabbos. And that's getting really interesting. Not only are Shabbos and Mishkan juxtaposed to say you should halt the construction of the Mishkan on Shabbos, but Shabbos is contoured based on Mishkan. Whatever was performed in the Mishkan and was halted on Shabbos during those Shabbos that they built the Mishkan is also halted on our Shabbos. So that experience of building a Mishkan but halting every 7 days was a proto-Shabbos, a proto-experience for something larger. That became the model. You literally were oseg in 39 melachas on Friday, building the Mishkan. Each melacha has its reference point in the Mishkan, not just in the daily sacrifices, but in the construction of the Mishkan. And as Shabbos, stop. Stop Zriya, stop Harisha, stop Katsira, stop Korea, stop Tzviya, stop. The only melacha that's mentioned, and it's only mentioned once, and it's only mentioned here. Out of all 39, the only melacha mentioned is which one? You know it. And it's mentioned here. Of all the listings of Shabbos, it's mentioned in Parshas Vayakhel. So there's something unique about Parshas Vayakhel and this setting and this moment and the fire that we don't get anywhere else. Oh, we have a little visitor. So I want to help our visitor, escort the visitor out of the room. Okay. Take them out. Just take them nicely. Thank you. Thank you, Tati. I think it's probably the neshama of a boy who never got to come back Shana Bet. Has been condemned to walk this world and find opportunities to live. That's what I think. Okay, yeah.
The worker needs the cat.
I won't pick him up, Tzvi, because I don't know where that cat's been. I think Tani's got a better idea.
He's here. He's actually been in this room a little
bit. Oh, wait. There we go. Okay. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Catman. Catman and Catwoman. Okay. Okay. So what's happening here in Parshas Vayakhel? Let's bring it back together. Why do we need to mention the Shabbos? Why is fire mentioned here? What's different about Parshas Kitisa? Parshas Kitisa is a halacha. Parshas Vayakhel is a Moser Shmuz. That's why I'm discussing it here. Parshas Kitisa says, it's Shabbos, you can't do melacha, Shabbos is so important, it overrides melachas of Mishkan, you think melachas of Mishkan is so important. But this is after the fact. This is after the Mishkan has been built. This is as it's happening, not just the tzivoyin theory in Parshas Kitisa. Now what has happened over the last couple weeks and months, not here in this yeshiva, maybe here as well, but over those weeks and months, right? Parshas Kitisa is Yom Kippur, Zalachti Kidvarecha, and between Parshas Kitisa and Parshas Vayakhel, about 2 months have elapsed. They built the Mishkan in 2 months, they concluded the Mishkan on Chanukah, and now it's either on Chanukah or it's around Nisan. Remember, Nisan is by Yom HaShmini, so no real time elapses on the calendar between Parshas Vayakhel and Shmini. It's all one long day, one long setting. So we're either on Chanukah time when the Mishkan is complete and Moshe gathers them, or we're Pesach time, Nisan time, right around now where the Mishkan is about to be constructed, or we don't really know where this Vayakhel Moshe takes place, but it's somewhere between after all the materials have been dedicated and either the construction has concluded or construction is in process, commencing. This is a major, major moment in human experience. The creativity, the imagination, the skill, the talent, the faculty, the vision that it takes to build a house for Hashem. This isn't a Lego. This isn't a couple of mud huts. This is fine art, fine dyeing, wool, linen, dyes, beauty, aesthetic, imagination. This is the most creative moment in human history, where human beings are expected to implement all that creative energy and all that unique talent and all that appreciation and fine craftsmanship and engineering and mathematical. And everyone's off expressing human talent and human identity and human creativity, whether it's art, whether it's math, whether it's engineering. And who created human creativity? Hashem made us creative. Hashem wants us to be creative, or else he won't have imbued us with those talents, and he certainly wouldn't have harnessed all those talents to build a house for him. Would have said, you know what, I'm building the Mishkan. It's not a place for human expression. It's too aggrandizing. It's too egotistical. I'm going to deliver a Mishkan from Shemayim, and you'll just receive it and enter it. But Hashem wants us to build, and he wants us to demonstrate our creativity and use it for religious purposes. But boy, creativity. That is a very, very dangerous dream because it's so powerful. And because it's so intoxicating, because we all like to feel good about ourselves, and we all like to feel that our ego has been expressed, and we all like to feel that we have something unique to deliver. And what do you feel? When's the last time you were creative? When you feel creative, you feel that you're different. And when you feel that you're different, your ego gets a boost. You're better than, you're different than, you're not the same. It's hard to feel monotonous. It's hard to feel like you're a number, not a name. And that's why it's so hard for creative and artistic people to be sincerely pious, to be sincerely reverential, because every artistic moment is an expression of self. It's an expression of the ego, an expression of whom you are. And ideally, that expression of self should be, well, Hashem gave me these talents, and I'm using them, and not to aggrandize myself, but L'shem Shemayim, because I really want to serve the Baruch Hu, I really want to make a Mishkan L'shem. But that's hard. It's hard to be both creative and to be reverential. I saw people who were like that, and I try to be that, but it's not easy. Rav Lichtenstein was the most pious person I will ever meet. The way that he said Kaddish, the way that he served the Rabbanu Shalom, the way that he felt he was an Eved Lifnei Rabbah, the way that he broke his will, he was also arguably the most creative person I'll ever meet. The two can be merged, but you have to work at it. Think of some of your friends, the people you know. Think of the people in life who you know are very creative. Are they submissive? Are they pious? Are they accepting? Are they hard? Think of the people who are very pious or very committed. Some of that piety sometimes is construed to them as suppress yourself and suppress your identity and suppress your will and suppress your feelings and suppress your belief system. Think of some of your friends in different yeshivas. I'm sure if you took the yeshivas, the programs that you're familiar with, and lined them up in a spectrum, you could probably line them up on this reverential creative spectrum. Is the yeshiva trying to create reverence and submission and piety and conformity? Well, then you're going to suffer creativity and self-expression. Is yeshiva looking to create self-expression and creative thought, as I think we try to empower this yeshiva? Well, challenge to be biased. Challenge to wake up. It's very, very easy to walk into a room and talk about Reb Chaim. It makes you feel really good that you understand Reb Chaim and tells us. A little harder to come to davening at 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning, because it's not overtly a moment of creativity. You'll feel like you're being... Truth is, the irony is you are being creative. Because creativity is also expressed in the ability to act in uncreative matter. That's creativity. I always laugh at people and say, I'm too creative for that experience. So what you're telling me is you're really not creative because you're just trapping yourself in one frequency. You can only do things that are creative. So what you're really telling me is you're not creative. Oh, I'm a creative person. I can't do that. So what you're telling me is you're not creative because you're stuck in profiling yourself as you are. You're not the most... The greatest creativity is to become diverse and versatile and to do things that aren't in your comfort zone. You want to be creative, can you also act in ways that aren't creative? If not, then you're not really creative. Because you're stuck in the mud and you're stuck in your own trap. Well, this is who I am. The best message I can give you guys in religion over the next 5-6 years is don't trap yourself. Don't probe. I'm this type of Jew. I'm that type of Jew. I'm this type of cat. I'm that type of cat. We have to have time to sit at the door, okay? The worst thing... Come on, a little harder. The pet that people aren't here. Well, keep those guys away.
They're quiet.
Okay, they'll go. They'll come after me. They'll sue me. The people can pass
on.
Okay. Okay. The best thing you could do over these couple of years is not to limit yourself and define yourself, and I'm this type of Jew and that type of Jew, and I'm math and I'm not science and I'm science and I'm not... I'm not sure if anyone listens to it. Okay. So this is a very, very dangerous moment in human history where human creativity can run amok. And human beings can turn away from Hashem because every expression of ego can only, this is a very heretical statement, but every expression of ego can only be expressed if you turn away slightly from Hashem, but you turn away in order to turn back. I remember once I was invited to give a lecture, and I know how to lecture, I've done it before. And I walked into the audience, and who was sitting in the front row? Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Basically took my speech and said, here, you read. I'm going to get up and talk to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. I felt so humbled in his presence, I couldn't express myself. I couldn't project myself. I couldn't bring myself. I felt like anything I would say would be so stupid and so meaningless and so futile. There was just no self to me. Once my ego had been completely pulverized, there was nothing to project. There was no me. I was just a cardboard cutout. I just read it. I remember just sat down. So if I really feel Hashem's presence in this room, then I just melt, I just disappear. So Hashem wants me at some point to think of myself in ways that are proudful and empowering and so that I can serve Him better, so I can build a Mishkan. So how is Rabbanu Shalom going to take this moment of unleashed creativity and turn it into piety and reverence and religious service rather than self-aggrandizing, egotistical vanity? How do you keep that in place? What's going to happen here? So the answer is this contextualization. And there are two things that contextualize. Number one, where does creativity come from? Well, creativity comes from Hashem. And I see it as a tool He gave me. And because it's a tool He gave me, I don't take any pride. It's not like I take pride in the tall person who made me tall. Hashem made me tall, so I don't take pride. Oh, I have black hair. Who gave me a brown hair? Here, brown hair. So I laugh at people when they say they're proud of how smart they are. Like, why would you be proud that Hashem made? First of all, smart is a handicap, just as it's an asset. But let's assume it's an asset when Hashem just gave you brain cells. Like, why? Are you proud of your wisdom? That's something else. Are you proud of your work ethic? That's proud of your character? Are you proud of your mindos? You're proud of your dedication? You're proud that you're brighter than the next guy? Like, why in the world? It's like saying I have brown hair and blue hair. Brown hair, red. Why are you proud of something that's totally natural, totally beyond my choice? Why should I be proud of something like that? So when I act creatively, I say, well, where did this creativity come from? It came from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Well, what is the image and the icon and the symbol of creativity in every single culture, not just Judaism, every single culture? What is creativity? Fire. How did human beings acquire fire? According to the Greeks, let's say. What are the Greek mythology?
Prometheus.
Stole it from the gods, because the gods didn't want human beings to have creativity, heat, energy, manufacturing capability, light. So we had to steal it from them, and of course Prometheus was bound to a rock as his punishment, to have his heart continually eaten out by birds. Prometheus bound. Well, where did we get fire from? Did we steal it from anyone? After Shabbos, after the first week, after HaKadosh Baruch Hu ended his Bria and rested, and we'll talk about resting on Shabbos, Hashem delivers fire to us. And Hashem passes the baton on to us and says, I finished my world. I finished my creation. We'll talk about that in a moment. Now I want you to perfect the world that I intentionally left imperfect. So here, take the baton. The fire is the baton. I'm now handing creativity to you. I want you to act creatively. And every Matzei Shabbos, I want you to make a bracha. When you make the bracha, Bari Marahesh, we're thanking Hashem for making us creative and for asking us to try to partner with Him in perfecting this world. So when I try to act creative, I say, wait a second, where does this all come from? Where does my creativity come from? It comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But the second part is even more powerful. When do we celebrate fire? And when do we make a bracha on fire? After Shabbos. Shabbos, I shut down my creative efforts. I shut down my creative self. Because I recognize that I'm acting like HaKadosh Baruch Hu who shut down His creative self. Because Hashem is infinite. And in theory, Hashem should have created infinitely because He's infinite, so He should have constantly been creating this world and constantly be creating this world. And He unnaturally withdrew from creation. On the sixth day after creating this world, He stopped in a way that was unnatural for Him. Because if HaKadosh Baruch Hu were to continue to create, there'd be no room for me to create. Not only because everything would be created by Hashem, because I wouldn't be here. I'd be turning into water, and you'd be turning into sand, and this world, the floor would be turning into mud. And all the stable laws of physics that allow us to create will be in constant flux, and our world will be in a constant dynamic state of change. And there'd be no room for human beings to live, let alone create. So Hashem created this world in 6 days, unnaturally withdrew on the seventh day. And every week I go through that process. Well, I try my hardest to shape this world with the tools Hashem gave me. And then I, like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, desist and withdraw. And I recognize that if Hashem hadn't withdrawn 5,783 years ago, there'd be no room for my creativity. And then I withdraw like He withdrew. Is everything all right, guys? I withdraw like He withdrew. And then after Shabbos, I start again. And to symbolize that new start, I take fire to make a bracha. I thank Hashem for creativity. So when I keep Shabbos, I'm contextualizing human creativity. I say there's a limit to how much human beings can achieve. And now all my creativity and all the self-aggrandizement and pride and overconfident swagger that creativity gives me, I'm trying to rein it in. I'm trying to remember this all comes from Hashem, and without Hashem withdrawing, there would be no room for my expression. Hashem wanted me to have an ego and wanted me to have an identity and wanted me to be proud of as long as it's in the service of a larger religious goal. And I will not stop being creative But I'll never let my creativity turn me away from piety and reverence. Because this is what Hashem wants for me. And Hashem doesn't want robots to serve him. He wants creative, empowered, thinking, doing, expressive people. But boy, is it hard. Think about all the people that are in show business. Why is show business and the world of arts and the world of entertainment, or more often than not a religious environment? Because you're projecting yourself. You are a celebrity. You want people to fall in love with your art, with your works of art, whether it's entertainment art or it's art itself or literature, because you're projecting yourself. It's really hard to be an artist or to be artistic or to be creative, to be reverential. But ultimately, that's a very powerful combination. When you're able to be the Vilna Gaon, and your creativity of anything makes you more pious because you feel that Hashem is directing you and leading you and you feel tasked and driven. It's not just guys that can be reconciled. Ultimately, that's the firmest place to be. But it's very, very hard to merge the two. And you have to be very, very sensitive to it over the next couple of years. I believe that one of the dangers, and I'm going to be speaking very, very frontally with you the next couple of weeks and months, one of the great dangers of not being in a Torah environment over the next couple of years is it's hard to find role models who help you balance out all your values. And when you're in university, you're in a hyper self-expressive environment. Express yourself, express your identity, prove your value, show yourself, achieve. And you're meeting very impressive people, at least, who are able to express themselves creatively. But you may not be meeting alongside of those people, pious people, who submit to the will of Hashem, even though it doesn't necessarily express itself as creativity. You have to be very conscious of the people you interact with and the people that you admire over the next couple of years, because you are still impressionable. And the people that will come into your life will shape you and shape your identity. And I don't believe for many people what makes them lose their religious piety, I'm not talking about losing your religion, but losing your piety, losing your avodas Hashem. At the end of the day, most of you, I hope, will remain firm. But unfortunately, if you don't reinforce it and strengthen it, it can become a very, very neutered form of firmkeit. It's just a keep Shabbos and a keep kashrus because that's my society, that's where I come from. But it's not something that gets me up in the morning. It's not something I feel passionate about. It's not something I sacrifice for. It's an accommodation. It's part of my life. It's not something that burns inside of me. And a lot of the MTA boys, you're just starting. You've been here for 2 or 3 months. What do we want from you in yeshiva? You're coming in, you're orthodox. More or less, if you never come to yeshiva, you'll remain orthodox. I don't think it's going to move the needle in your orthodoxy. It's a question of whether you'll be passionate about it. Like, do you care more about your avodas Hashem or do you care? I'm not asking you to answer the question for me. I'm asking a rhetorical question. Be honest, or do you care more about the cricket match and more about food and more about your profession? And in many, many cases, I think the answer is the latter. You come in and those, you're religious, you're good kids, you're obedient kids. It's not like you wake up in the morning, I am a Jew and I'm an Oved Hashem and that's my identity. Of course, I have to make a living and I enjoy the culture around me and I enjoy the food around me, but essentially all my hub of identities, my avodas Hashem, that's what we're trying to accomplish. And if these things take a long time, they take 4, 5, 6, 7 years to settle. I'm not talking about becoming a Talmid Chacham. That's an entirely different project. How much Torah you'll learn, how much Torah you'll be able to learn. Just identity. It's so hard to spend 1 year in yeshiva and lock in that identity. And you have to be very conscious of it. So you have a professor who is very impressive and very, very eloquent and very bright, and you start being drawn to that person's example. You start to be insane. You want to become like that person, and you don't pick up. Creative people can also be pious. In fact, the more creative you are, the more pious you can be. And have an eye over these next couple of years to find people and to find teachers and to find role models. So you know what? That person is very committed, devoted, passionate, pious, from, keeps the halacha carefully. Or, in theory, you could find someone that's not Jewish who expresses those traits. But don't find yourself getting lost only into this cauldron of creativity. People who are creative and artistic and how impressive they are and how bright they are. And that's the contextualization the Torah is trying to provide by mentioning at this moment, after all the creativity has been expressed, or while it's being expressed, not theoretically, before it starts, don't build the Mishkan when Shabbos comes. Right now, real time, you're building the Mishkan, stop. And which malacha should you stop from? creative actions. All the creative, that's why on Shabbos, any action that is not creative is not Aser Min HaTorah. We call that Mekalkel. Any action that doesn't create something that's counterproductive is not Aser, because Hashem specifically targets creative acts that have to be suspended on Shabbos. But Hashem wants us to check our creativity on sundown of the Friday night until sundown of Matzei Shabbos. Check your creativity. So the Mishkan is this burst of creative expression, and Shabbos is when all that creativity has to be condensed and withdrawn, to remember that without HaKadosh Baruch Hu's withdrawal, there'd be no room for our creativity. And then after Shabbos, we get the baton again from Hashem symbolically. Go out and start your week again and create my world, but check it in another 7 days. Parallel to what I said. If you want to survive, if you have a half of a hope to survive with deep, committed Jewish identity after you leave your 1 year in yeshiva and you're not in a firm environment, you have to be very, very conscious of Shabbos. Shabbos cannot just be a day of relaxing, unplugging, turning your phone off, and having good meals and friends and sleep. Because that's where the culture is taking it, because the week is just so harried and so frenetic and so pressured. So what is Shabbos? Of course, turn the phone off, daven, eat, friends, family. During the week, your week will be so a-spiritual. Because of the pressures of your schedule, because of the people in your life, you have to say, this is a 24-hour time oasis where I have to think about how am I going to re-spiritualize myself. And if Shabbos is just food, rest, and friends, then the backwash and the regression that takes place during the week will go unchecked. If Shabbos is a revitalization, how am I going to turn this into a spiritual experience? Then it may not be like yeshiva, you may not be learning with the same intensity, but at least you feel that there's some kickback, some response. I wish I had more time, I wish I could do more, but after all, I'm stuck in college, I'm stuck in the army, but at least on Shabbos. And to make that happen, you have to plan. Think about how is this Shabbos going to be a spiritual revival. It's less important in yeshiva, that's where a lot of kids get it wrong. In yeshiva, it's all right for Shabbos just to be a 24-hour letdown to rest, because you were working so hard during the week. You need to sleep, you need to recover, you need to rest. But when you get out of yeshiva and you don't have that religious drive, Shabbos, and you're tired to begin with, there has to be some moment where it's Friday night before you open the newspaper, before you go to some friends, before you go to the tish, Shabbos morning, you wake up early before davening, or before you have the shalom, or you'll miss your nap in the afternoon or something. There has to be some moment. It could be through Talmud Torah. It could be you taking your davening more seriously. You don't get to come to davening on time during the week. Shabbos would be very makbid to come on time and say korbanos. It could be you'll learn. It could be you'll go to a shir that someone will hear. It has to be a moment, or else it's not. You're going to find yourself falling and spiraling and free falling. That's why Shabbos is mentioned in the beginning of Vayakkel. This is post creativity. And Hashem is trying to contextualize it. Okay, let's see what else we're going to talk about tonight. Okay. Let's talk about sarcasm. It's been a while since we talked about sarcasm, okay? Bright people have greater proclivity to being, just going to ask some of the gum chewers. Remember that we have a rule that we don't chew gum or eat in the class, we drink, but we don't chew gum. So nothing to be embarrassed about. You may have forgotten. Please don't swallow your gum. That's not good. Tell your mom now, just take it out. No problem. Nothing to be embarrassed about. Okay, I chew gum also. Okay, so sarcasm and cynicism. Bright people have been proven biologically, neurologically, to be more cynical. The part of the brain that leads to cynicism is larger in people of greater intelligence. I don't need neurology to tell me that. I know from life. Why? Because cynicism means that you don't accept things and get excited about them. You could analyze and find the flaw in anything and then hyperinflate that flaw and say, well, that person or that thing or that idea really isn't worth because I found the flaw. So people of lesser intelligence get excited. They see something good, someone good, an experience that's good, an idea that's good. They go, oh, that's amazing. Whereas bright people start to analyze and start to twirl their fingers and start to understand what the good parts are, what the bad parts are, and all of a sudden, oh, it's so bad. Look, I found the negative. I found the flaw. I found the loop. I found the problem. And that whole thing is sunk because I hyperinflate the problem. So we talked about this a little bit earlier in the year. Let's talk about it a little bit more. I'll just generalize and introduce. If you are looking for one trait in this room and in this yeshiva to work hard on, is make sure you try to nip cynicism in the bud, sarcasm in the bud. If you are a sarcastic person, you are heading into a very, very, very dark place. You will not be happy with yourself in 30 years. That I can promise you. Because you will start being sarcastic and cynical. For now, let's not distinguish between the two, about the people you meet, people at work, And then the circle gets tighter because your cynicism becomes contagious and you start becoming cynical and sarcastic about people in your family. And it's actually easier to be because you know them better. So it's easier to be sarcastic about people closer to you, your friends and family, because you actually know them and you can find the flaws even though they seem to be doing great things. And then at a certain point, after you've spilled your venom into everyone you know and your family and friends, there's only one target left for your cynicism. And it starts to become shooting yourself in the leg with your own cynicism. You don't believe in anything. You're a bitter old man, and nothing in this world works, and nothing in this world is of value. And then you're cut off from anything, from friends, from family, and you're cut off from hope and belief. So stop the cynicism as quickly as you can. And the best way to stop the cynicism is to try to find people, as with every trait, try to find people who aren't cynical and spend time with them, because you'll see it will rub off on you. So if you're a particular person who makes fun of Rebbein, who makes fun of parents, who makes fun of friends, I don't mean sitting in the back and saying, oh, the Targum's an idiot. I'm just, oh, you know, he did this. You know what cynicism is. Not this, not the vitriolic hatred. No one here sitting in the back telling, you know, cursing me out in the basement. Just, oh, yeah, he did this, and he's this, and he's that, and that person this. Because you always know how to offset someone's great qualities and great impact by finding the one aspect. You just pull the rug from under out, and the whole thing falls apart. If you're that person, I don't care. You're not going to affect my life. But your life is going to be very, very, very sad. Find someone to marry who's not cynical. Find friends who are not cynical. Find people who are not cynical. Cynicism is poison. The more you let it into your world, the more it will destroy you. And we see the sad folly and the sad lunacy of cynicism in this week's parsha. What happens in the Medrash? In Parshas Pekudei, we're skipping out to number four. Medrash says, Te'alamna sifsei sheker. The false tongues, in this case the cynical tongues, should be silenced. They should become elim. So the Medrash evidently feels that around this time in Parshas Pekudei, Vayaka Pekudei, there were some cynics who were saying certain things about Moshe Rabbeinu. And somehow, the success of the Mishkan and the success of Vayaka Pekudei quieted them. So the Medrash is going to describe their cynicism. What were they cynical about? And this helps us check our own cynicism, or, additionally, not just check these cynical comments that may come up in your own life, but, alternatively, you may be exposed to cynicism, and you have to learn how to be exposed to cynicism. When's the last time someone said something cynical about you, or you felt that you had to work through cynicism? People who denied you, people who questioned you, people who made fun of you. So cynicism, there are two challenges. One is not to be cynical, to be pure, to be naive. Some people are cynical because they feel, oh, can't be naive, I can't be fooled, I have to make sure that I doubt everyone, I can't be taken advantage of, I can't be, you know what? Here's me telling you, I'd rather go to my grave after 120 years being fooled a couple times because I'm too naive, rather than going to my grave never being fooled but being a cynical old man. I'll take it. Everything in life carries a price. Everything has a price tag. No free lunches. If I can script a world for myself that's pure and noble and believing in people and believing in what they say and believing in the good in people and humanism, and the price for that is every once in a while I will place my trust in someone who dashes it and someone who betrays it and I suffer from that, that's an exchange I'd be happy to take. Because the other side, doubting everyone and not believing in anyone and questioning anything and everything and not having any source of nobility and purity, but knowing that I'm not going to... People ask sometimes, say, what happens when a mashulach comes to my door? Should I give him tzedakah? And the answer is, not that you should, you have to give tzedakah. If an ani sticks their hand out and you don't give tzedakah, if you have money, you're over at least one iser, possibly two iser. There's no choice. You are mechuyev, it's like not putting on filling. If an ani comes and asks you for money and you have reason, like $100 bill, it's like I need $100 bill. But if you have a shekel, two shekels, two, whatever it is, and you don't give the money, you're over an iser. So what about when mashulach comes to the door and there's a X percent chance that maybe they're not an ani? Let's let our minds, I think it's probably very small because who would spend the time going door to door if they didn't need it in their mind? But let's, for argument's sake, for the sake of this argument, say that it's 20%, which is, in my opinion, a totally swelled and exaggerated figure. But let's assume, just for the point of the argument, that 20% of the people that come to my door are not legitimate aniyim. They're scammers. Again, it's hard for me to imagine, but just to make the point. I would rather go to my grave shelling out 20% of my tzedakah funds inappropriately and not missing the other 80, they're not giving tzedakah because I was so suspicious of who came and didn't come. That's a price tag I'm willing to take. I'm willing to take. Everything in life carries a price. You can't always sit there and defend your money and have every other value that you want. Sometimes you have to spend money for things you don't want to spend on, because they'll give you not necessarily assets or goods or food or services. They'll give you, for example, when I make weddings in my family, I'm always overspending. Why? Because sometimes it's for the good of my child, sometimes it's for the good of my mechutan, sometimes it's for the good. So I'm willing to spend for happiness. How much money do people spend for happiness in their life? How much money do people spend on psychologists who can help them be more happy? If I know that this money can create happiness in my family, in the families together, I'm happy to spend that money. You have to learn to spend money, even though you're not getting anything tangible in return, because you're getting happiness and peace of mind and serenity, which obviously you can't put a price on that one. Someone has to pay more money for that, not less money. People don't get that right all the time. So many marriages fall apart because of arguments about money. Obviously, there's something deeper. But if the money weren't an issue, then the arguments maybe could be contained. And people don't realize, what do you mean? I'd be happy to spend money on something I don't want to spend on, because it'll give me marital happiness. And just how much money would I be spending on marriage counseling? And so I'm happy if this is something I don't want to spend on, because it makes my wife happy. Again, I hope it doesn't come to that. I hope you want to spend money on something that makes your wife happy, because you want to make your wife happy. Not because you want to avoid marital strife, avoid psychologists and marriage counseling, because it's important to you to make your other person living with happy. But you have to learn in life that you sometimes spend money on things that don't create tangible returns. They create larger returns. So I would rather spend money and waste my money on all those scammers who are coming to my door, because that's money I'm happy to pay, not to fail in a Mrs. Essay. Because there's going to be one honey who really is an honey, and I'll suspect him of being a scammer, and I won't give him. So if you told me that, how much money do I get stuck? I'm not a really big giver. I don't have that much money. It's a 5 shekel here, 10 shekel there, 30 shekel, whatever I'm giving. So I'd rather give, let's say, 20% of all that money I'll be giving in my life at my door. What's it going to be? $20,000. How much money am I going to give at my door? I'm not talking about the institutional money again. How much money am I going to give at my door? Take all the money I'm giving, again, 200,000 shekel maybe, money that I'm going to give at my door. I'm not giving major funds at the door. I'm not talking about minus any more part. So if you take 20% of 20,000, so 30,000, I'm happy to go to my grave 30,000 shekel poorer to know that I didn't avoid Mrs. Essay's right and left. So it's the same thing here. I'd rather be someone who's pure and trustful and believing and committed to other people and seeing the good in other people. Will I be taken advantage of? Of course I will. I'm 57 years old. I give you a long list of people who took advantage of me. But you know what? I'm happy. Because that's a price I'm happy to pay for the type of life I'm trying to build for myself. Where I'm happy with people, and no one doesn't talk to me, and I'm not fighting with anyone, I'm not angry at anyone, and I can sleep at night. I put my head aside. I know when things bother me, I can't sleep at night. You know how much money I'd pay for a good night's sleep? A lot of money. So I'm willing to pay emotional prices to know that I can go to sleep at night, and I don't think that I have any enemies who dislike me, or I dislike them, and I can't talk to them, and I feel they're trying to get. I live in a world that I'm trying to create a world for myself that's kind, that's pleasant, that's harmonious, not constantly confrontations and disagreements and suspicion and doubt. So what's happening, the cynical world surrounding Moshe? So one form of cynicism is Moshe's got these great dreams. I mean, we take it for granted, Mishkan and Beis HaMikdash, but could you imagine putting yourself in their shoes and hearing Moshe speak about, let's building a house for Hashem in the middle of the desert. These are people just underwent Har Sinai. They just failed Hashem at the eagle. But you know what? We're going to build this Mishkan, and Hashem's presence is going to descend into this house. And you can imagine a couple people looking at Moshe going like this. You got to look at me, guys. Give me the Ellie stare. Really? Your silly little beams of wood in the middle of this desert are going to have the presence of Hashem. We saw the presence of Hashem. It burns mountains. It creates infernal fire. We're terrified. It splits waters. It pummels Egyptians. You're not creating a little Lego piece and having Hashem's presence in there. As nice as you think this little tinker toy is, Moshe Rabbeinu, it ain't happening. What's happening here? Well, we're trying to make you guys into idealists in this issue. Dreamers. Dare to believe that you can do something beyond. What beyond are you going to accomplish in this world? When I meet you 25 years from now, one of the questions that you will have to answer in order for me to consider you a success is the following question. Here it is. Which ideal do you live for beyond your own comfort? If you don't have an answer to that question, I don't like to use the F word. I don't like to say anyone's a failure, but I don't know. You put on this world just to have a nicer car and a nicer home and a nicer pool and a nicer family. And at some point, it just runs out. All that stuff gets dry really quick. It's old really quickly. So you could tell me, you know what, I'm committed to Talmud Torah in ways that my previous generation parents were not. Nothing accusational about the previous generation. Every generation serves as a platform and a springboard for the next generation. I grew up in, where were anyone from Perth in the room now? Any Perth guys there? No. I grew up in Perth, and my parents didn't have so much access to Talmud Torah, but here I am, and I've made a change, and now I'm flipping the script, and I'm creating a generation of people that will learn Torah seriously. Well, you know what? My ideal is the state of Israel. I live in Israel. I made Aliyah through great sacrifice, but I'm raising my children in Israel. Or my sacrifice, I'm living in Chutz Lars, but I'm so dedicated to bringing Israel into my community, into my life. Or you know what? I come from a broken home, and my parents' marriage wasn't great, but I'm just doing it better. I'm going to create a beautiful marriage and raise my kid in a house of serenity and calm and comfort and security. Whatever. I don't care what it is. It has to be part of your Avodas Hashem. So my ideal is, I don't know, I'm going to travel to the moon. Travel to the moon is fine. So not an ideal. I'm only going to make you more religious or less religious, unless you want to dive a minch on the moon, first minion on the moon. And I'm going to make the first minion for minch on the moon. Ten astronauts to get what? Right. Ten astronauts together. Whatever, right? But that's what's his name, Rothschild, you know. Okay. So, but there has to be some ideal you're living for. Now, here's the hard part, okay? Ideals are always unknown. You'll never know whether you'll meet those ideals. That's why it's much easier not to follow your ideals, because everything else. I remember when I was in Smicha. So all my friends were graduating college and getting jobs, or they were in the process of getting jobs. So in those days, it was the 1980s, and Wall Street needed a lot of accountants, and they were offering my friends $80,000, $90,000 right after college. So it was clear, objective benchmarks for their success. Then I had friends in law school, and every year they took their tests, and they said, I'm fourth in my class. And you're fourth in my class, I can project my success down the line. Who was that? I was a little stinker in Smicha studying Hilchos Shabbos. And there was no clear signs. I was working on some large-term ideal, some large-term goal. I wanted to make Aliyah. I was saving money for Aliyah. I wanted to be a Rebbe one day, and I was working hard to be that Rebbe. It was a long-term goal that wasn't quantifiable, it wasn't concrete, it wasn't easy to be seen. And when you embark on those long journeys for great visions, you will encounter your fair share of people that will doubt you and that will scorn you and that will mock you and say, what do you mean? Why are you dreaming? Why are you thinking? Why are you yearning? What do you mean this won't happen? Because they can't see the future. And they can't see the future because it's not there yet. You're creating something new. That's the definition of an ideal. That's the definition of a vision. You're creating something out of nothing. You're creating a reality which isn't there. If you want a stable, concretized, quantified life, it's all there. You go to law school, it's fine. You're choosing a different area to express your idealism. But if you go to law school and you get a certain rank in your class, you know where you'll be in 4 years. But the ideals you're dreaming, even if you do go to law school, they're not something you can quantify. That's why they're an ideal. They're a concept. And people will doubt you and people will scorn you. I can tell you the amount of people that doubted me and scorned me and made fun of me and doubted me and questioned me. And I just had to drum up enough internal conviction to say, I'm doing this. And you have to meet people that have done it to give you the faith. I remember all the time that people mocked me or made fun of me, I just kept thinking in some crazy way, well, Rav Lichtenstein did it, so I can do it. Not that I'm anywhere close to his level, but I took a cue from the idealism that he expressed. And you have to meet people who are idealists. You know what? That person made it happen. That person worked through all the scorn and cynicism I'm going through as well. So let's hear Moshe Rabbeinu working through it. Te'alam Sifsei Sheker, source 4, part Aleph. Te'alam Sifsei Sheker. Okay? Amar Moshe Lisa, V'ichali Truma. Moshe starts the process. Line number 2. Haya Moshe Osa B'mishkan. V'hayu Leitzani Hador. Omrim, the Leitzanim, were saying, the cynics. Esus Eschina Sharai De Ben Amram. This human being who comes from a man and comes from a woman's womb is all of a sudden going to bring down the Shekhinah? Namely, they were doubting his vision. They were doubting his long-term goals. So it's not so. It's not just a cakewalk for Moshe to build the Mishkan. And everyone's celebrating and everyone's clapping and everyone's awarding Moshe. There are people mocking him on the sideline. And I think a lot of people lose their conviction when they face mockery. And part of the way you have to succeed in life is to learn not to be affected by scorn and cynicism and people that joke about you. Every Muslim yeshiva in Europe had its one trait which they identified as the core trait of religious identity, and they worked hard on that trait. One of the great Musar schools in Europe was called the Navardak Musar School. And in that, when I say school, not yeshiva, in that approach, in the Navardak Musar approach, they felt that the primary trait to being an Oved Hashem was learning to resist and to defy people's scorn. Because they felt if you cave and capitulate when people make fun of you, you will not have the backbone to continue your convictions and your principles. So they would actively train the Talmidim how to face and stand down people's scorn. And they would actively, in a strange way, take actions that would elicit scorn and mockery in order to condition themselves not to be affected by it. So, for example, a Talmud in the Varjav, I'm just giving an example, would walk into a grocery store and say, "Can I please have a beam of wood?" And the grocery store owner would look at him, "You idiot, you lunatic, this is for food. We don't sell beams of wood. You're a fool." They would train themselves not to be affected by public ridicule. So they would take actions that would intentionally generate ridicule to train themselves not to cave to ridicule. Okay, don't do that. Don't say to them, "Oh, Targan told me we have to be a Navarre duck. I'll take my pizza and shove it in Gabe's face and have him make fun of me. I don't care." Don't act radically and extreme. But learn not to be so thin-skinned. Learn not to. One of the things Rav Lach said, you can't imagine some of the things. These are the old days of ideological arguments in the 80s and 90s. Some of the things people said about Rav Lach and Singh made me crazy. I never heard him retaliate. I never heard him say anything. He didn't feel like he had to. You have to have a thick skin in life. The problem is you can't be too thick because then you're not sensitive and compassionate. It's easy to be completely thick-skinned and not care and be aloof, and then you don't care what people think about you. And then you don't care about people because you don't care what they think about you. It's easy to be very sensitive, very compassionate, and then you're very vulnerable to people's opinion. You're trying to hit that sweet spot where you're sensitive and caring and engaged and interested and available emotionally, but what people say about you and your choices, not about your behavior. Let's say someone says, "You know what, you can improve in this area." Since, okay, maybe I should be improving. That's not, "Oh, I don't care about you. Maybe I could improve. I want positive feedback." But if someone doubts my integrity and doubts my principles and doubts my sincerity and doubts my commitment and doubts my program, you know what? At this point, I'm checking out. At this point, I need to have a thick enough skin and that's Moshe's image in Parshas Bikurim. Everyone's sitting on the sidelines laughing at him. And they're laughing about something else. What happened? Source number base. Amar lehem Moshe, bo v'nasa b'mishkan, v'nachashe lefnechem. Sheshama Moshe litzan yishol medaber me'acharav. Here's an interesting part. Why does Moshe create such a comprehensive accounting in Pekudei? Eile Pekudei ha-mishkan. X amount of gold, and X amount of silver, and X amount of dyes, and X amount of wool, and X amount of... You know why? Because where people actually questioning and say, ha. We know that Moshe Rabbeinu is skimming some of the profits of the Mishkan. How did he become so rich? They were looking at Moshe as he walked to his tent. Let's just, we have a few minutes left, so I'll read this very quickly. So on the next page, V'bitu achrei Moshe, Rav Chama Amar, Adam, they were saying, the end of the second line, Adam sheshalat amlechus ha-Mishkan, a person that all these funds available, einatam mevakei shiyashir. Of course he's going to be rich, because he's dipping into the public funds, he's dipping into the public tills. So Moshe says, "You know what? I'm going to be as transparent as possible. I'm going to give you a precise accounting. This is how much gold we collected. Here it is. X was used for the menorah. Y was used for the shulchan. Z was used for the aron. A was used for the brichim. X amount of kesef. Y was used for the adonim. Z was used for the lulos." Very, very careful to be as transparent as possible, not to give people... And unjustifiable. He could have said, "Look, I know I'm right, and I'm doing the right thing, and I'm not stealing. To heck with people's opinion. I know that I'm right." But if you want people to be inspired about you, you have to be careful, not just about what they correctly think about you, but even if they incorrectly. So, Mirat Hashem, you'll be back for Pesach, okay? And you'll be back for Pesach, and you'll be standing in shul. And maybe there's a friend of yours that didn't go to yeshiva. Maybe there's a friend of yours that went to yeshiva, but, you know, his or her mind weren't in yeshiva. And you're going to talk to him in Kriyas Atar. Let's see. And your friend is going to look at you, "Ha, ha, ha, he went to yeshiva. He's talking during Kriya Satara. You know, this whole thing's a whole bunch of jokes, and, you know, I can be over Nagia." Whoa. Well, what is that? First of all, I went to yeshiva. I'm not the Vilna Gaon. I'm just a little nothing, a little shmagegi. Second of all, how do you get from talking during Kriya Satara to being over Nagia? It's not right. It doesn't make sense. Yeah. But if you care about the value system and you want others to be inspired about it, you're not just worried about correct extrapolations, you're worried about incorrect extrapolations also. It's not, "Oh, you're making a wrong extrapolation, it's your fault." It's not a question of who's at fault. The question is, what's the conclusion? What's the end game? What happens in the end? So sometimes you may be unfairly accused, but it doesn't make a difference. In the end, you're not interested in who's right and who's wrong, right? When I stay up at night worrying about you guys in yeshiva, as I do, I think I'm right. I think you guys are babies sometimes. I think you guys are immature. I think you guys, I'm saying it as it is. You're not. But at the end of the day, it's not like who's right or who's wrong. At the end of the day, I care about your neshama, and I care that you guys should be successful. So whether I'm right or you're wrong, that's not the yardstick. The yardstick is, how can I make you successful? How can we get through to you? And if you are unfairly interpreting something about me or about this yeshiva or not sufficiently internalizing it, oh, that person is so immature, he just can't, he's faking himself. Okay, great. I'm just going to cut that person off. I care about you deeply. So it's not in the end whether I'm right or you're right. At the end of the day is, I just want you to be successful. And I have to worry about how you can be successful in your own possibly mistaken, possibly 18-year. I can't judge you. I have to try to help you. So Moshe Rabbeinu could have very easily said, come on, guys. I spent 40 days and 40 nights, three times, not eating and drinking. And this is what you guys are thinking. I don't care about you guys. Go fly a kite. I know that I'm right. I know that I didn't steal or I didn't graft any money. There's no corruption here. And let's move on. And I don't need Parshas Pekudei. And who has to read Pekudei again? He says, you know what? I'm going to give an accounting. It's demeaning, right? It's demeaning to Moshe. I have to give an accounting. I'm Moshe Rabbeinu. Last time I checked, you wouldn't be here without me. I have to give an accounting for you. But for Moshe, it's not a question of who's right or who's wrong. Moshe doesn't want them to scorn. And the only way he can help them not scorn him is by being transparent. I have one more minute, so just talk about how we are moving to a world in which we have to be more and more transparent, because unfortunately, A, there's a lot more scorn and cynicism in our world, and sadly, a lot more abuse in our world. It's very important in Jewish institutions to be as transparent as possible about the way we conduct institutions and shuls and decisions and policies and money and all sorts of factors, because we live in a very, very cynical world. And even though I know I'm right, I have to create a world in which people are able to see that I'm right and honest and sincere and integrity, or else our message won't get across. And we're going to lose a lot, trust me. This transparency that we're moving towards, we're going to lose a lot, because we're going to demystify and take away the mystique, you know, everything is just accounting and people in the room and the larger conversation. But the more important message is, Moshe doesn't just ask himself, am I right or wrong? Moshe says, bottom line, I have to make sure these people walk away inspired. For me to do that, I have to conduct a comprehensive and tedious accounting that, in the end of the day, is embarrassing to Moshe. It's embarrassing to subject Moshe to this accounting. Come on, Moshe Rabbeinu has to file his tax forms and be audited by all this scorning and mocking riffraff of Am Yisrael. This is the goal. This is how you expect Sefer Shemos to end, with Moshe giving an accounting. The answer is, that's Moshe's heroism. At the end of the day, I have to make sure these people are able to appreciate that moment of Yiridas Hashchina and celebrate the Mishkan, rather than doubting how rich I may have been and may have become by taking money in their minds in the Mishkan. So I'm willing to go through the task of creating an accounting. Okay, let's go down. 2 minutes, still davening. 2 minutes.